Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're listening. This is Davisville on KDRTLP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. You can find us online anytime at kdrt.org/Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan. I'm your host. Delighted that you've tuned in today. We've got a great show, and I'll start by describing a combination of experiences that I'm pretty sure has never been true of just one person before. And the combination is DJ for a vanished 1970s Yolo County radio station, and astronaut. It's not the usual resume, but both those descriptions apply to today's main guest, Steve Robinson. He's a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at the University of California, Davis. He's also the director of the UC Davis Center for Space Flight Research. He's a retired NASA astronaut who flew four times in the space shuttle and spent more than 20 hours spacewalking. But before he did any of that, he was a student at UC Davis and a founding disc jockey for a small Davis area radio station, KYLO. And this love of music continues. Steve has even played guitar in a band whose members are all astronauts. And radio-wise, anyone listening to this station, KDRT, will have a chance to hear him as an occasional stand-in for Rod Mosianko, who hosts the music program Silver 9-Volt Heart. Rod's known as Rodriguez on the program. So both Rod and Steve are in the studio with us today on Davisville. And our subjects, they're going to vary. They're going to include space travel, KYLO, and music. We've even got a clip from Steve's first show on KYLO's first day. But we'll begin with space. So Steve and Rod, thank you for spending time with us today.
You're welcome, Bill.
Thanks for having us, Bill.
I'm delighted you guys are here. So Steve, I grew up watching the Apollo moon launches. You know, I was 12 when Neil Armstrong stepped on the moon and we watched it in the black and white TV image. Spaceflight seems to me like the ultimate mix of science and magic. You know, science for the obvious reasons, and magic because you're in space, you know, something that wasn't possible until just 60 years ago. You, of course, have been up there. And I'm wondering, what has impressed you about the experience of going to space, of leaving Earth?
It does stay with you, let me tell you. It leaves indelible memories. And let me just say, anyone who's actually made it to space is an extremely fortunate person. Because a lot goes into the preparation for it. But luck is a big player. And for me, I certainly feel lucky to have had those experiences. And I'm still lucky today. And you're right. You know, I tell my students, when I was born, of course, they already think I'm totally ancient, which I am. But I tell them, when I was born, nothing made by humans had ever orbited this Earth.
Yeah.
So the opportunities, the experience, and sort of the self-knowledge of humanity to know that we could do that is changing rapidly. You know, that's only two generations.
Yeah. Actually, I'm going to want to talk about that a little bit with regards to the latest space flight, or the one that's due in a minute. We not to out your age, but you were born in 1955, just to help peg people.
Yep.
When what years we're talking about, because that was it. The late 50s was the end of, let's say, the non-space age.
That is right. And as, you know, humans started going to space, the Russians and the U.S. to begin with, it was just such a big thing in society. And all kids wanted to be astronauts.
Yeah. Well, how about you? Did you want to be an astronaut?
Yeah, I just never grew out of it. I mean, yeah, I was born wanting to fly. I don't know why.
Okay.
It was never a decision I had to make. I always wanted to do that. It was a long road, you know.
Well, yeah, the training that you have to go through, the rigor of it. I would imagine that any of the early astronauts, when I would include you, because it's still, what, not even 1,000 people maybe have been to space yet.
I think when I went, I was somewhere in the 350s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So not enough, I'll tell you that.
So I would imagine that a lot of the early astronauts really wanted to do that because of what you would have to give up to go.
Well, I will. My hat's totally off. My helmet's off to the earliest astronauts because it was incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
And flying in space still is dangerous, but not as dangerous as it was back then. So, you know, the Alan Shepherds and Gus Grissoms and John Glenns, they were incredibly brave to all of our benefit.
Yeah. So I was trying to imagine what it would be like to be out there and knowing the work that goes into it. I guess I was thinking, when you're up there, you've got a job to do if you're on the space station or if you're still in the shuttle. You know, a lot of things to monitor. You've obviously got very defined working conditions. But outside the window is the Earth, this bright and blue against dark space. Such a mix of very focused and innovative and detailed work with a lot of danger, but also transcendence.
That's a really good word to use. And I will say that I think anybody who flies in space is very aware of the danger. You sort of have to keep that awareness in your pocket at all times because things could happen rapidly and other people are counting on you. Yeah. You're counting on them. So that's an awareness. But it isn't this sense of impending terror of it by any means. It's very peaceful and it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
And you're continually thinking, oh, my gosh, my dream came true and it's better than I thought it was going to be by a lot.
So you said you were lucky. That alone would make you a very lucky human, right? You said that the value of spaceflight, one of them anyway, is that it helps us learn more about how to live here on Earth in our environment here. I wondered if you could expand on that.
Well, one of the things that spaceflight does is it's a technology engine. So many of the things that we count on for our modern life, especially in the affluent societies that we live in, have their birthright in the space program. And so we talk about miniaturization of electronics and computer software engineering, long-distance reliable communication, many, many things that it just seems they don't seem like inventions or things that we're aware of. They're just part of life, mm-hmm. but they didn't used to be. And we wouldn't be where we are now if we'd never had a space program. And it's still the case.
Yeah, I've been reminded about how this is making me think of it, about how motors, you know, used to be external. Computers used to be external, and eventually they get integrated into the thing so that, you know, the computer is just part of this microphone system. It's no longer an external thing. Space travel, I suppose, is bringing discoveries like that into our lives.
It's a driver for that. And I think one of the things that we're working towards, I think everybody in human spaceflight, is the integration of technology and human limitation. We all have physical limitations, and they change as we grow, and they depend on who we are and how we were born or what kind of things have befallen us during our lives. Technology can augment and extend our abilities in physical and even intellectual ways, perceptive ways, for sure. And this is why I actually am at UC Davis, to help develop some of these things.
Well, okay, let's talk about that, because I didn't know until a few years. Actually, I talked with Ashley Coates, who I think might have been a student of yours.
Yeah.
Sometimes I talk to the top graduate each year, and about 10 years ago, I talked with her.
Oh, she's great.
And she's working for NASA now, I understand.
Yes, she is.
I was looking this up. Wonderful to talk with her. But I think it was at that interview that I understood how deep the connections are between NASA and UC Davis. I had no idea. I think of NASA as being Florida and Texas and maybe Southern California, but not here. Here is vets and yes, engineering and certainly agriculture.
There's been threads between UC Davis and NASA for decades and decades.
So how did that get started?
Well, I don't know. There wasn't too much of it. When I was an undergraduate here, so I started here in 1973 at UC Davis. And during that time, I ran out of money, so I had to leave school twice. But I was fortunate in that I was able to get an internship at NASA Ames Research Center down in Mountain View. And for me, that was the start. And I was totally unqualified to do such a thing as a sophomore at UC Davis.
Oh, they must not have thought so.
Oh, no, they thought so, too. They just didn't. Oh. It was too late. They couldn't get rid of me.
Okay.
I do remember my first day, my boss sitting me down and looking at me and go, well, there must be something we can do with you. That's what he said.
Okay,
but real shot in the arm.
Yeah, I mean, okay.
That was my first day at NASA.
But you've been on 4 shuttle flights, so, you know, I think so clearly
was
there
right
was something
in the
there.
End. Yeah. But right now we have lots of students who have internships with NASA, quite a few who've gone on to join NASA as a career, but there's not just NASA now. You know, when I was a student, if you wanted to get into space, it's the only place you could go. And now there's a kind of a spectrum of commercial companies, some fairly large, some you've never heard of, that are hiring UC Davis students to push the forefront, the pioneering spirit of spaceflight exploration forward.
Well, so what brought you back to UC Davis? And I want to add, as part of this question, I guess, I heard you talk on YouTube that part of your center is it integrates a lot of different disciplines. And I know Davis has a reputation for being able to work across disciplines. You know, was that it? Was that what brought you here?
Yeah, the dedication and kind of experiential expertise and collaboration that UC Davis has. I don't know why UC Davis has that. I don't think you'd find anybody who can really explain it, but it is truly what we are. And it's kind of known across the country that is the case. So that was one reason I came back. I've been to other schools, other universities, and it wasn't like that.
Yeah, you have 2 degrees from Stanford as well. That was your PhD and your master's.
I spent quite a long time at Stanford, and I spent some time at Princeton, and I spent some time at MIT. And of course, I've had, you know, research collaborations in many other places. So when it was time to leave NASA after 37 years, I thought, well, if I'm going to teach in life, I better get with it.
Yeah. Space travel and what it involves is ultimately more than science. And it's not just poetry either, but it's like psychology and medicine and all these things as well, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's every kind of engineering you can imagine, but it is psychology. It's neuroscience. It's physiology. It's medicine. It's very strongly psychology, the integration of humans being where they don't belong, you know, humans being in a highly hazardous place where they could die in an instant if something went wrong, are completely dependent on technology and engineering products. So how do you integrate these humans in a very productive way? So they're not just kept safe by technology. They're actually augmented by technology. You become a better human when you're in space, a more capable human, let's say. Maybe not a better one.
So this goes back to the point about how things you learn in space apply at Earth. I mean, what you just described could also be described of what we're doing generally these days with AI. How do we integrate it into our work? How do we integrate it into, you know, our voting or all these sorts of things?
Yeah. And any new technology that comes along, you know, microelectronics or all kinds of sensors that is, let's take human health, you know. What you can learn about your body when you go to the doctors or hospital now is vastly different than it was 20 years ago even.
And I heard that you said that there's some similarities between going to space and aging in terms of the effect physically.
Going into space and what?
Aging.
Well, we'll see, won't we? But yes, there are some things. I'll give you an example, kind of an obvious example. This is a hot research topic right now, but a simple example is when you're in space, if you don't load your bones, you will lose bone mass.
Strength. So putting stress on and things like that.
Right. Yeah. If you're not putting loading on your bones, and which is pretty similar to osteoporosis. And so if you can study osteoporotic responses in a human that is otherwise very healthy, now not very old, it can provide you some insights of sort of that process in the body that in isolation of other complicating factors, which we don't really get on Earth mostly.
I did want to talk a little bit about America's latest space flight, because I think in a way it illustrates what you were saying a minute ago. It's scheduled for May 17th now. It's been delayed a couple times. This is Boeing's Starliner.
Yep.
And this is going to be the first flight with a crew.
Yes.
So Boeing is making spaceships, or at least, you know, they're trying to get them ready anyway. Elon Musk's SpaceX is going. There's other countries going up. Space flight, in other words, becoming a little less unusual. As you look ahead, do you think it will ever become routine?
I'm of two minds. My heart says, well, I certainly hope so, because the more people that have this experience, the better off the whole human race is. I firmly believe that. The engineer and the kind of the safety pilot and safety realist in me says, well, if you want to go to space, I have to take your body and I have to accelerate it to about 17,500 miles per hour. And now you have a huge amount of energy due to motion and energy due to height above the Earth. Now you have to dissipate all that energy back safely so that you can become back on Earth. Both of those things are massively dangerous and difficult. So routine is a difficult word to put to all that energy transfer.
I'm intrigued by the first part of your answer when you said you really hope more people have the experience. What is it you want them to see or feel or learn?
Well, you're stretching my ability to speak about things that you only feel You know, when you go to space, especially when you go outside the spacecraft, you know, new experiences we normally explain to other people through analogy. Analogies don't work.
Oh, for a spacewalk.
Yeah, there is nothing even remotely like that in my experience.
Yeah, I've watched a few spacewalks, you know.
They're really boring from the outside.
Well, until you think about what's happening, at least for me.
Well, yeah, you can transfer your mind.
And then I think, okay, here's this person out in space walking around on the outside of a spacecraft and, you know, you're tethered. But that strikes me as the limit of human experience.
Yeah, it struck me that way too. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And you were there.
Yeah, I was there. Well, you know, I remember looking around and thinking everything I can see is, you know, that wasn't made by humans. Actually, there was a case where I was outside on the robot arm for the International Space Station, and I was faced out to space. I couldn't see any of the spacecraft at all. So everything that I could see was bigger than me, much older than me, and is going to outlast me, much more persistent. And I thought, oh, I'm just a speck in space and time. That stays with you.
Okay. You know, I would have thought, Stephen, that you would have said, this reminds me of that diorama that I did in fifth grade in Mrs. Fields' class.
Thank goodness it was better than that.
We do a quick station ID. We are talking with Steve Robinson. And then that was Rodriguez, you just heard right there, Rod Masianko, who's a DJ here. This is Davisville on KDRT 95.7 FM in Davis, California, kdrt.org online. I'm Bill Buchanan. We're talking about space, and we're about to start talking about a radio station that used to exist here. In fact, this is probably a good time to shift. I want to play a clip. This is a clip that Steve, you sent, and it's from your first day and your first show on what at the time was a radio station that doesn't exist now, called KYLO. Let's just listen to this here, and then I'm going to ask you to tell me a little bit about it.
Here's a couple fellows by the name of Killef and Eckley with Billy O'Billy, preceded by Herb Peterson and Sandman, and started out with Jesse Colin Young, and it's a lovely day. And it is a lovely day here at 609. My name's Steve Robinson, and it's my pleasure to introduce KYLO to you. Beginning our first day of full-scale operations, and believe me, I'm proud to be here. We're at 105.5 on your FM dial, just in case you don't know where you are, and we're going to be doing progressive country from now until the cows come home. If you're laying there in bed, I think it'd be a good idea just to stay there and listen to some good music with Willie Nelson. I love
you. That.
So what did we just hear there? Remember what day that was, or...
I don't. I'd have to look that up. But this would have been in
78
or 79.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. This is where Rod's going to come into the conversation because he knows about KYLO also.
Or
knows
I something. Sure do. I was an avid listener of KYLO.
So you were listening to Steve.
I didn't know it, but yeah, I was. Yeah.
You kind of had to be because for quite a while I was the only DJ there.
So how did you end up starting at a solo DJ station in the middle of Yolo County, which would have been, you know, I don't know, 1/5 the population we have now or something?
Like most things, not by planning and whatsoever. I had just graduated from school and I was broke, so I needed a job. And I saw, probably in the Davis Enterprise must have been, that there was a local radio station starting up. And as far as I know, this is the only commercial radio station Davis ever had.
KYLO.
Yeah. And they were starting up, and they were so, let's say, cheap that they weren't going to hire a graphic artist to generate their, you know, their logo and stuff like that. So they made it a contest, and the winner would get $50. So, you know, I'm a starving graduate, and $50 sounded pretty good to me, and I'd had a background in graphic arts. So I sat down at the kitchen table and painted up a logo and brought it into them, and I won. I won the contest. Now, nobody ever told me if there were any other entries, but...
It was a damn good logo. We had them on our cars. I mean, we were proud to listen to KYLO. Well, so,
and then after you got the $50, did they say, hey, do you want to do a show?
No, it wasn't quite that simple. They said, come over to the station. And I had been working at KDVS for years on
campus. That's the campus radio station.
The campus radio station at UC Davis. And I was the program director, in fact. So I was in charge of, you know, all the music and the training of the DJs and stuff. And I remember we had 90-something DJs there at the time. So I was, yeah, I was really into radio. I'm amazed that I graduated, actually. But So they invited me over to get my $50, and I thought, wow, this is exciting. I get to see another radio station. I'd never seen another one.
And eat.
And what?
And eat.
And eat.
Yeah. And maybe, yeah.
At least until I go out. But they did pay you. They were cheap, but they paid you?
They gave me the $50, and we were standing there talking, and this place was over just outside of where Aggie Village is right now. They were talking about, well, we're getting ready to start, and we're going to just have one DJ. That's all we can afford for a while. And so if you know anybody, I'm like, well, actually, because I hadn't told them anything about my background. Uh-huh. So one thing led to another, and they hired me as their first and only DJ. And so what the clip you just heard was the first day the station went on the air.
So there's a story. There was a time you were at the station, and you were running out of records to play.
Oh, yeah, all the records were my own. And, you know, how many records does a college student have?
Yeah, so you went on air and said, hey, I'm running out of LPs.
Yeah.
And tell us what happened.
Oh, yeah, I asked for donations. And people just showed up with record collections in the trunk of their car. I couldn't believe it. And in one day, our record collection grew by a factor of 8 or so. It was very successful. They were the most scratched up records you ever heard also.
You know, and this gets to something that... Yeah, both of you said, Rod, how you used to listen and things like that, and I could hear the affection in your voice.
We could pull in the signal from Sacramento.
Oh.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that with KDRT.
Had a very directional signal. We know this because I put a map up on the board, and I would ask people to call in and tell me where you are because we had no idea what our coverage was.
Well, a marketing guy, too. Aces.
Well, it was just interesting. So I was putting pins in the map.
So, but this was community radio, right? I mean, this was radio, and I think social media has inherited some of this sort of community sense that radio had at one point. Because I also remember growing up in the South Bay listening to radio, and your radio station, who you listened to, what you heard, the music it played, you know, it helped create that sense of community that I think social media now does. We here at KDRT actually try very hard to recreate that, or not just recreate it, just simply create it. But you had that at the time, and the story about the vinyl coming in, I think, shows it. Here you're at this station that's brand new or fairly new. You're the only DJ. You don't really know who's listening, but you put that out and people bring you their records. They must have liked what you were doing.
Well, we were very, very touched by that. In fact, we were kind of amazed that many people listened. But
we've had that phenomenon down here sometimes.
Yeah, I know you know what I mean.
So what happened to the station? Rod, or do you or Steve? Or?
Well, one thing I would like to say is that the timing of KYLO beginning was really cool, and here's why, at least from my perspective. Right about then, there was a station down in Gilroy called KFAT.
Oh, yeah.
And they were one of the first stations in the whole United States to actively play Willie Nelson, who was then in his period what was known as outlaw country. And the word Americana applying to music really wasn't around. And in a sense, Willie Nelson became the pioneer of Americana based on these small radio stations like KFAT or KYLO. And there was a lot of people that were tired of listening to pop. They got burned out on rock and roll and a lot of its offshoots, glamour rock and all this stuff. And they really gravitated to this cool sound that was going on. And that's one of the things that we loved about KYLO is that they really embodied that sound that we were all looking for. It was very earthy, and it reached out and said, come get some more. And I think it had a big place in this area, too, because, you know, agriculture was even bigger. Yeah, in 1978 well, than it is now as far as how many people actually did it, you know.
It didn't last, though.
No.
Well, you know, actually, the part about agriculture is true because I read an experiment. I had to start the shows at 6 in the morning, and I was sure nobody was listening. So what I did was I had a fondness for very classic country music from the 50s. So I would play that for the first hour from 6 to 7. Because I knew I was playing records just for me. Nobody else would be up and listening to this station. I was wrong. You know who was listening? Was guys out on their tractors with transistor radios. And their spouses would call in and go, hey, John's out there. It's, you know, he's
that's beautiful.
Drilling corn or something. And he wants to hear Leroy Van Dyke, you know. And so that hour became, I knew who my audience was. And there were working people in the fields.
Yeah, okay, so this is the value of music.
And back in Sacramento in that time period, and before, there was a station called KRAK. Yeah. And it was a stone-cold country station. And they really put out the kind of music that Steve's talking about right now. And it was, the place was epic. But really what happened is that that extra stuff came up and people went for a newer sound. And yeah, so you had your morning audience and then you had a different audience probably after they woke up from the previous night's activities.
Yeah, I changed it over. Next thing you know, I'm playing, you know, Panama Red and stuff like that.
New Riders of the Purple Sage.
Exactly, exactly. I don't know what happened to the station. I left before before the station.
Yeah, I know it had some format changes and call letter changes.
Well, they did hire some more DJs.
Yeah.
And I was involved in deciding who would get hired, and some of my DJ friends and friends from other places got hired as we expanded the station for a while.
So we just got a couple minutes left. One of the reasons that you're both here today together, because otherwise it's kind of an odd mashup, right? Music and space.
It is.
But it's because Rod does the show Silver 9-Volt Heart. And Steve, you're going to be, as I understand it, an occasional fill-in host for that show.
Well, you know, I love radio, and I have been listening to Rod's show. I came back to Davis in 2012, and it couldn't have been too long after that that I was looking for some good radio, and I found some good radio with Rod's show. How long have you been doing that show?
Well, I've been on the air with KDRT since 27.
Wow. Yeah, he's done a few different shows. Yeah.
But this one here I've been at for about 10 plus years. Yeah.
So you heard Rod's show, and you thought, I like that.
Well, I even better than I like that, I thought, this kind of radio is still alive. It was very exciting to me. And so I just listened, you know, many times. And I'd call in here sometimes and nobody would ever answer. And mostly because it was probably recorded and I didn't know that.
Yeah, we do have replays of our shows. Yeah. Well, so, okay. And
so
I know,
I'm a fan is what I really am.
Okay, so then so you approached Rod and said, hey, are you ever looking for a backup kind of thing?
Yeah. And that's kind of where it's got. And we're in the process of going through some of the pre-on-the-air requirements. We'll get those done, and away we go.
You see, I have to say, one of the themes I have on Davisville is that Davis just has a ton of interesting stories. And this strikes me as sort of a very Davis moment. You're doing a show, and Steve, you're an astronaut. You are, you know, a world figure in other things. And you're saying, you know, hey, I want to come and do that. And it's great. It's all right here on the show.
Well, these two jobs, radio DJ and astronaut, came together in a very, very valuable way. I worked at NASA in Houston, and I was assigned as an astronaut to work in mission control. My job was called the capsule communicator, or CAPCOM. And the CAPCOM's job is to be the voice that speaks to the crew in space. The idea being that who's speaking to the crew in space should be somebody who's also an astronaut, understands the terminology, knows the people. And for at least 15 years, I was working in mission control on and off, basically being a DJ for the space shuttle and the space station.
You know, we're going to have to end the show because we're out of time, but that's not a bad way to end the show. You've just integrated the two things. Oh, this is great. Well, we've been talking with Steve Robinson, professor at UC Davis, retired astronaut, and Rod Mosianko Rodriguez, you'll know him as, for the host of Silver 9-Volt Heart. This is Davisville on KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California, KDRT.org. Rod and Steve, thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Bill and Rod.
I'm Bill Buchanan. Thanks for listening.